Yes, indeed. Make It Right. That's the Soul Jazz Orchestra out of Ottawa, Canada, with People, People. It happens to be one of my favorites. It's from their 2008 album, Manifesto. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And a week-long hunger strike by University of Missouri graduate student Jonathan Butler was the catalyst for broader action against an administration that repeatedly failed to address complaints of racism and discrimination at the flagship Columbia campus. The students' demands were met yesterday with the unexpected and yet expected resignations of President Tim Wolfe and Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton. It was a teachable moment, as our President Barack Obama would probably have said. Let's listen now to the announcement by President Wolf yesterday. This came just as the Board of Governors of the university were to have a pretty long meeting involving what would become of his presidency, and I suppose he headed that off with the announcement. Here it is.
I'm resigning as president of the University of Missouri system. My motivation in making this decision comes from love. I love MU, Columbia, where I grew up, in the state of Missouri. I have thought and prayed about this decision. It's the right thing to do. The response to this announcement, I'm sure, ranges from joy for some to anger to others, and that's why we're here today. So let me speak to why this is so important at this time. To our students, from concerned students 1950 to our grad students, football players and other students, the frustration and anger that I see is clear, real, and I don't doubt it for a second. To the faculty and staff who have expressed their anger, their frustration, it too is real. To my friends and my supporters that have been so gracious and have sent so many emails and texts and calls of support, I understand that you might be frustrated as well. So the question really is why did we get to this very difficult situation? It is my belief we stopped listening to each other. We didn't respond or react. We got frustrated with each other, and we forced individuals like Jonathan Butler to take immediate action or unusual steps to effect change. This is not, I repeat, not the way change should come about. Change comes from listening, learning, caring, and conversation. And we have to respect each other enough to stop yelling at each other and start listening and quit intimidating each other through either our role or whatever means that we decide to use. Unfortunately, this has not happened, and that is why I stand before you today. And I take full responsibility for this frustration, and I take full responsibility for the inaction that has occurred. I'd ask everybody, from students to faculty, staff, to my friends, everybody, use my resignation to heal and start talking again, to make the changes necessary. And let's focus on changing what we can change today and in the future, not what we can't change, which is what happened in the past. I truly love everybody here in the great institution, and my decision to resign comes out of love, not hate. I'd like to read some scripture that's given me strength. I hope it provides you with some strength as well as we think about what's next. I have to also give credit to my daughter for reminding me of the scripture. Psalm 46:1. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. We need to use my resignation. Please, please use this resignation to heal, not to hate. And let's move forward together for a brighter tomorrow. God bless all of you, and I thank you for this wonderful opportunity to have led the University of Missouri system. Thank you.
That was President Tim Wolf announcing his resignation yesterday ahead of a meeting by the University of Missouri's Board of Governors that came about as a result of this week-long hunger strike by the graduate student he referred to, Jonathan Butler. This was accompanied by a broader initiative in support of Jonathan Butler, but also in support of the ongoing protest in so many ways that had been occurring on the campus of the University of Missouri. Several incidents had occurred that raised questions about the general atmosphere on campus, that to the minds of the African-American students and Jewish students as well, was racist and openly so. And the administration had been notified of these incidents. Students were concerned not only about the open manifestation of this kind of conduct, but also that it was a sort of intimidation. It was an act of open disdain, and they began to be concerned about their safety on campus. So apparently they had several incidents in which they brought to the attention of the administration, and nothing was done. Now, the speech we heard was quite contrite and very, you know, as speeches go, you can tell it was quite emotional from the point of view of the way people publicly behave when they are of that stature. He sounded very contrite, as I said, very sorry. However, when you pay attention to the language, you hear something very profound, and it is a kind of closeted non-apology. On the surface, it sounds like he's making an apology. On the surface, it sounds like he is atoning for his failure to do something about this. But in the end, there were great hints in that speech that suggest he's not really, this is not about atoning, truly atoning for anything. This is not an act of contrition. This is something else. And, of course, you know, we decipher and dissect speeches here on this program because, as I remind you, there are several levels of meaning when people speak. And certainly when one speaks in an official capacity, as the president of the University of Missouri has, we hear, we listen harder for those levels of meaning. And I was wondering whether you caught any of it. Now, as part of the background to our discussion, keep in mind what has happened here. Okay, so Jonathan Butler began his hunger strike the football team, which is overwhelmingly African American, throws its weight behind him in solidarity with him and in solidarity with all of the African American students on campus who are similarly situated and similarly offended. They refuse, they said, to continue with their program, their athletic program, which includes several games against other universities in which big money had been invested. And in the immediate case, they were going to be losing, they were going to be forfeiting as much as $1 million if they didn't show up for the game. So there's big money on the line. Still, the team, as well as the coach, and then it decided that they were going to be in solidarity with this cause, not just Jonathan Butler, but with the cause. And then it grew even larger to members of faculty, many of them expressing solidarity with this. And then it grew even larger. We had people outside of the strict university community expressing solidarity with it and watching this. And then we had media coverage of it. So the story began to mushroom. It began to get bigger and bigger. And so the University of Missouri began to say, well, wait a minute, we can't ignore this. This is not something that is going to just go away. We have to pay attention. And so this meeting was called of the Board of Governors, ostensibly to find a way out. And the way out was, of course, the resignation of the president, the resignation of the chancellor. But now we will deconstruct this as to what we think really happened here and why it happened. What was the major catalyst here for this event to go this route? What do you think was really the issue here that just made this all turn out the way it did? And of course, the ripple effects are coming. But we are dealing with the issue of the moment, the resignation of a president because of pressure by the students, the resignation of the chancellor because of pressure, the consolidation of effort, and the focus now on the University of Missouri as being typical of many other campuses where racism has been brought to the attention of authorities, but nothing done, where we have campuses all over the country with a similar concern by the student body. What to your mind actually occurred here, and what do you think of the president's speech? What is he saying? What are the levels of meaning are you getting from what you just heard? You must have paid attention to some of the key words. What did you hear, and what does it make you think about this particular scenario? But in the larger sense, when we talk about this, when people, when an event, an issue just blows up like this, the issue, of course, centering on the, I call it the flaw in the fabric of American life, which is race oppression, white supremacy, and how it is dealt with. Your thoughts at 888-874-4888. What was the nation confronted with? How was this handled? And what care was taken here to save face, to assure the public that there was a very swift and decisive response? After all, the heads of pretty high up in officials did roll. It appears as if the students did win. But really, what do you think happened? What is your analysis of the situation? 888-874-4888. In the meantime, also in the state of Missouri, in fact, just about 120 miles away, the city of Ferguson, you remember that city, it's the city that blew up after the shooting death on August 9th last year of 18-year-old Michael Brown by then police officer Darren Wilson. The city exploded and became not only the immediate nexus and epicenter of the discussion on police use of force and police brutality, but it became the issue for the nation about the state of affairs and the social and political and economic arrangements in cities like Ferguson all over America that dictate how life is lived every day. But in the city of Ferguson, over the weekend, we had the interim police chief, Andre Anderson, making the first of several public appearances he'd be making at local community groups and churches and so forth, saying that the city of Ferguson is moving affirmatively to bridge the long-standing gap, the rift between the community and the police. And what will be the solution? He says the solution will be old-style policing. Old-style policing. And old-style policing will involve police officers going out on the street and talking to people and taking time to get to know the people and assuring them that they're there to serve the same way that they serve in white communities. They were there as friends. They were there to secure the safety of individuals in these communities. They were there to be the good guys. No need to be afraid. No need to have suspicion. No need to continue that long-standing rift. So the interim chief is on a mission. This is an outreach program. He is going into the communities to discuss the new approach that the city of Ferguson has to policing. Your thoughts about that? This old-style policing. You know, you always have to listen real carefully to when officials speak, because they are speaking at about three or four different levels. And very often, the assumption is, or the hope is, that you have a short historical memory, or none at all. And you are unable to put what they say up against the long history of things similarly said long time ago, and which turned out to have an entirely different result, despite all the promises made, despite all the good intentions articulated. We have a long history of the same old, same old, same old, same old. So we have two major lessons learned here in the state of Missouri. One yesterday and one over the weekend that says, let's say a thing or two about what we are to think about when these events happen, they get coverage, and we are told that these are the issues. The media reported the situation in the matter of the University of Missouri in a particular way. It reported it just as I said. This is a great victory for students. And now the second leg, the second round of coverage is now talking about the upswing and the re-emergence and the resurgence of student activities and college campus activities because of this one incident, that the people power brought this result around. And it will go through their permutations. Their journalistic coverage will take all these different angles to it. But there's something quite profound here that has happened. And it has to do with the insistence, just the same, that just the same way that the President Tim Wolf has apologized and taken full responsibility, he says. If you listen to his language, he is saying something else. And the university, by offering his head to the public on a silver platter, the head of the chancellor on a silver platter, they are saying to the public, all is well. We have moved decisively now that we have learned about a problem. We have responded appropriately. We have taken severe action. And you have the result that you want. Now, is that what happened here? How do you deconstruct this? Who will get us started? How do you deconstruct what has happened here? So that we understand that this carefully choreographed event, this news conference, this very contrite and sad former president of the university supplanted by supposedly student power and protest on campus over the issue of his failure to adequately deal with the continued complaints about racism on campus and the feeling among students of color, among some Jewish students, that their safety was imperiled because of the conduct of fellow students on campus that appeared to have gone unpunished or unattended to. So it looks like a very efficient response. I'm interested. What happened? You tell me, or share with us, what you think was going on here. Is this really what it is? Or is there something else that we need to pay attention to? What would you say was the critical cause of everything that we witnessed yesterday and everything that we know today on campus? In the situation in Ferguson, where the interim police chief, an African American, is making the rounds to tell the local people that it's a new day. However, the new day is about old-fashioned policing. Should that make them comfortable? Old-fashioned, old-style policing? Is that something that Ferguson wants? Is that something that they should be reticent about? We'll take this break and come back to your calls right after this. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are dissecting what is presented to us today as a reality. In fact, in two instances, both in the same state and both concerning the same thing in a way, and that is white supremacy. In the one case, it is located on a college campus, the University of Missouri, where students had taken action against the administration, saying that the administration had failed consistently to deal with their complaints about incidents and about issues relating to racism and discrimination on campus. And on the other, it is in the city of Ferguson, Missouri, where the newly appointed interim police chief is making the rounds to assure locals that something is being done in the aftermath of the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown by then police officer Darren Wilson, that he is saying it's a new day in Ferguson, and this new day is about old-style policing. In any event, we have this being these two items, these two incidents, being presented to us as the public as news events, news developments that suggest progress, and that suggest progress by a particular result, the result of African-American agitation. And so something has been achieved here through the old-fashioned civil rights type activity. And here again, civil rights type activity had been successful in both instances. In the case of the University of Missouri, civil rights type activity on the part of the students and the broader community who began to become involved, it was the notion, the notion that civil rights action and activism causes to happen. In Ferguson, the civil rights activity had resulted in national and international attention being drawn to Ferguson, and Ferguson became symbolic and emblematic of the age-old struggle, civil rights struggle in the United States, the right of African Americans even simply to be safe in their own person and being inordinately prone to being victims of state violence. But that's happening here, and that is also to condition us to accept that that is what happened, and it is not exactly the only thing that happened. In the case of the University of Missouri, if you listen to the speech by the now ex-president, what you understand is they will not credit, they will not give credit for the accuracy of the tactics used by the African-American students at all. And that is, it was, yes, you know, it had that flavor of the civil rights, but they were strategic. And that is, they hit the university in its pocketbook. The results were quickly achieved by changing tactics, by employing very, very important tactics. And that is, they didn't care. I mean, if it were a civil rights type thing only, the university would have, you know, it would have probably gone on a little bit and asked the president, look, do something, have a meeting, do something, and left it up to him to figure it out, do something symbolic, you know, meet with them, you know, sing Kumbaya and talk about your days, how you walked together over the Edmund Pettus Bridge too. But that's not the tactic these students took. They used the civil rights type struggle as a bonding agent to consolidate their strength. But they directed their energy at cutting this university down at the knees, which is in the pocketbook. That's the language they understand. And that's why within a week, we have a result. The football team that had been historically the generator of revenue, in this case, you see the University of Missouri, like any other plantation system, the African Americans supplying the labor for free, the university reaping the benefits of their labor and their investment as athletes in their football team, bringing them success, bringing them revenues. The minute they started saying things like, "We ain't gonna be playing. We shall not be playing until this matter is resolved," then the university understood the language they were speaking. They were speaking the language. This was not just about kumbaya, let's hold hands and sing several choruses of "We Shall Overcome." This was, "We are prepared to cost you money." And it was the money factor that triggered everybody's interest. Because now the president is not just simply an administrator. The president is seen as the guy between financial success or financial ruin for the college. And like any other corporation, anybody who can't manage that and yet is a CEO, you gotta go. If you can't handle your plantation, you have to go. So these students, and this is very important to take a note of, they behaved completely differently from the plantation formula. This was not plantation behavior. And they signaled to the authorities, to the president and to the chancellor and to the board of governors, not only are we going to do this now, but we have laid an entirely new strategy for anybody else coming behind us. That the way we fight you in order for you to do the right thing by us, the way we secure our rights is to use the leverage we have to make your life a living hell. And that is to threaten your economic survival. And that is incredible. So yes, they will still give President Wolf a way out. He could still come before the microphone because now he is fighting for his life. He now has to be concerned about his afterlife. He no longer is within the University of Missouri system as of yesterday. And so, even so, he is saying things like, "We stopped listening to each other." The way I heard it, the students were clear that this was a one-way street. They were talking to him and he wasn't talking back. He's very grand now, very messianic, very leader-like, but still indicating that it is not him. We have to start listening and learning and caring and having conversations with each other. Well, good that you found out on your way out. But as we understand it, this is what the students had been asking for a long time, and which you were absolutely adamantly opposed to doing. But he has to say these things because now he has to look for a job. And he has, in this last moment, this final moment, he has to be publicly seen as a conciliator, as a humble guy. But still he can't let go. He's talking about, let us act out of love. Now he's a big prophet and disciple. Let's act out of love and not hate. What is he saying? He's implying hate was the motivator. He's implying that the students' actions, in part, involved hate. You see? So when you listen to what people say, you listen for all these levels of meaning. He's even quoting the scriptures, for crying out loud, about God being our refuge and strength. Well, you guess what? If he were clued in at all, he would know that the majority of the households these students come from, this is already known. This is well known. The scriptures are well known. But the point I wanted to drive home here is that until these students employed this strategy of saying, we are prepared to tear up your financial security and your financial arrangements, and we can do so because we are the producers of it. And if we wish to, we can destroy it. We have the power. We have the leverage. And that is the brilliance of their tactic and strategy. And that, too, was very, very pleasing to me because it suggested that these students also reached back. This was not something that they invented. They got it from somewhere. And hopefully they got it from the instruction left by those like Marcus Garvey and others who laid it out. This is how you operate. You have to understand systems, and when you understand systems, you understand how to tackle them, how to fight them, especially on the matter of injustice. And that is the beautiful lesson of yesterday. Leaving President Tim Wolfe and Chancellor Lofton to try and gather up the remnants of whatever they passed as their characters, as their so-called moral fiber and all of that stuff. Bottom line, it's about money. And they understood, the students, money is power. And since they are the generators of the money, they are the custodians of power. And therefore, you can strategically deal with, you can deal with the system more effectively that way. From Rosedale, Jose, you're on the air. What have you to say?
Good afternoon, my professor. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you,
my co-professor?
How are you?
You know, you have taught this elder well. And I almost didn't want to hang up because you have covered everything that I was about to say. But in addition to that, you know, I think the administration, the system was afraid that this might could very well wind up being like an Arab Spring.
Yes.
That this thing could move from that university to other universities where our young black men are the ones that create wealth in these universities. And they have nothing to show for it. They have been abused, misused, and so they feel that our young men must accept these conditions. And so, again, as you said, they have so much power in their hands, and now they're starting to utilize that power. And I was hoping that those black men in the professional sports would get some of those spunk, some of that courage that these young people have shown, because they have so much power in their hands, but they refuse to use it. You know, when that incident happened, where the coach that that basketball owner you referred to black folks in those derogatory terms. So you remember that incident?
Yes, the Clippers owner. I can't call his name right off the top of my head.
I thought that, yes, this was the moment that these grown men, these athletes, these professional black athletes was going to take a principled stand and see that this man get run out of town. And I said to myself that now is the time that we are going to see black folks stand up and say, we want to take over this franchise. We have a tendency to get on the right track, and we make moves that will bring the system, will cause the system to stop and to make adjustments. But we stop right there because we tend to always compromise our power away. And so what the rewards that we could have gotten if we had tarried, if we had pushed on and make demands, we stop somewhere along the way and we just cave in. And I'm tired of our people looking for apologies. I couldn't give 12 rats, you know what, if this man apologized. What I want to see is that the young people, they use their energy and their power to press for everything that they want and demand.
Yes, but at the same time, we also have to note the stark absence in terms of their support of the established leadership. And perhaps that too was an excellent thing, because it means they did this completely on their own. Thank you so much for your contribution today. Thank you.
Thank you, my professor, and may you continue to have good health for as long as time science is around with us, okay?
Thank you so much. From Virginia, Walter, you on the air.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
I'm a listener, first-time caller, and it's an honor and a privilege to speak with you.
Same here. Could I ask whether you're on speakerphone?
Yes, I am. Is this better?
Yes, speak directly into it because we pick up the reverberated sound.
Okay, is this better?
And we want to hear your wonderful voice as clearly as possible.
All right. Well, thank you. Yes, I just want to co-sign what you've been saying about what occurred at the University of Missouri. What we have been lacking as people of color to try to get advancement in social justice movements is basically, in my view, a three-prong approach. We've always been out in the streets in terms of the protesting. That's one prong. But I think, as you were saying, with the established leaders, they are often discredited because of their particular personal histories versus those of the folks who are earnest protesters, particularly some of the younger people in the streets who are basically focused on objects and goals versus money and polls. The second part of that three-prong approach would be...
I'm chuckling because it is so well said. Thank you.
The second part of that approach would be a legislative approach. Back in the days where we had Thurgood Marshall leading the legislative sphere for social justice issues for people of color, we had a leadership that was, again, focused on results. Whereas now we only have a few folks like Mr. Maddox who are really focused on true advancement and true legislative victories versus settling for either money or settling for either media attention. The third prong in that approach is something that I feel has been severely lacking and that you have basically pointed out today in the argument with the University of Missouri, and that is a strategic financial approach. And to me, of those three, that's probably the most important, where we can have a focused financial impact on the revenue base of the system that produces racism, white supremacy. And that's basically all I wanted to say. We've always had the power. We're like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. We've always had the power to go home all along. We just didn't know it, okay, or just didn't fulfill or realize it. And that power lies in the unity of our financial strength.
Thank you very much, Walter, for calling in and contributing your pearls of wisdom today. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
In the matter of Ferguson, Missouri, with the interim chief of police Andre Anderson making the rounds into the community to assure people that it's a new day, but it's a new day because he will be employing old-style policing. I think he deserves some credit for going out into the community personally and trying to bridge the gap. However, we have to keep in mind that he is a representative of a system that even the Justice Department said was lousy and discriminatory and racist and not yet fixed. So what is this old-style policing? To my mind, that is exactly what was wrong with Ferguson, Missouri. Old-style policing was what was the problem. Old-style policing gave Ferguson, Missouri, 50 of the 53 police officers were white in a predominantly African-American town. That's old-style policing. Old-style policing targeted, according to the Justice Department itself, it targeted people of color for harassment and ticketing and fines. And that was how, you remember, we discussed this on this program, that accounted for the vast majority of the revenue of the city of Ferguson. And police were the agents of that system. So is that too part of old-style policing? Are the people of Ferguson to be assured that a cop who shows up and shakes your hand and tells you all this kind of stuff, in any way, does that change the system of policing? Policing at its root in Ferguson, Missouri, everyone in a position to assess it has said it is bad, it is racist, it is lopsided, it targets the African-American community there. And they have been made to bear an inordinate share of the burden of taxes and the burden of revenue. And remember, we just talked about the firm, a multinational company right there in Ferguson, not paying that much in taxes. But it's the people of Ferguson, the ordinary people of Ferguson, who are socked with taxes. We have this imbalance. We have not heard about old-style policing being challenged with a new-style approach to recruiting and looking at the way the policing system functions. Is going out into the community and shaking hands going to change that? I don't think so. And it says something again, and I'm not suggesting in any way that Chief Anderson is in any way disingenuous. He's probably quite genuine about his desire to bridge the gap. But he is not understanding the problem. It's a systemic problem in Ferguson that so far has not really been corrected. So it can't be solved by palling around. Officers coming up to you and say, "Hey, Fred, hey, Mary, how you doing today?" It does not change the nature of the political and social and power arrangements in Ferguson, Missouri. So in the end, it is to be of concern to the people of Ferguson, Missouri, and to others observing how the city is trying to say to the rest of the world, we are changing. What they're saying so far is, we are doing some cosmetic stuff, but the structure so far has remained decidedly intact. There's no changing going on there. Now, until Chief Andre Anderson can assure the people of Ferguson with concrete examples of a dramatic change within the structure of the policing of Ferguson, then all these other things that they're doing, the glad handing and the handshaking and going to churches and talking to people, all of that is simply cosmetic. All of that is platitudes. All of that is to get people quiet and to get them to accept a reality that just does not exist so far. Now, in the middle of all of this, we still have no definitive movement from the Department of Justice other than the report it issued that confirmed what people have been saying all these years. The Justice Department didn't really do anything new except it added statistics to what had been saying, what the people had been saying all these years. So the people have been correct all these years to point out that the system was rotten to the core. The Justice Department now puts percentage points behind that, but it doesn't change essentially the charge that had been standing there for so long. Nothing would convince the people of Ferguson more about change than to see change, not to hear about it, not a public relations effort, not running around and, you know, you are the black chief and you coming to talk to us. You one of us. We saw what happened with the president. Same thing. You know, don't come to the neighborhood to glad hand and talk. But come to present concrete ways in which improvements are going to be made or have already been made. Now that is old style policing that's been completely overhauled. That's what you ought to do. I thank you for joining me today. I hope this program did something to get you to look at things a little bit differently. And always to question, because the reality that we are presented by definition is not the reality that we ought to be hooking into. It's manufactured. And there is only one purpose for that, and that is to control your minds, because in controlling your mind, you control your actions. You control your decisions. They control your decisions, I should say. Thank you for joining me today. Stay right here on PRN.FM. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can always reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And as always, I thank you for the level of conversation that you contribute to every day on this program. And I thank you for the pleasure and the great privilege of your company. Bye-bye. Keep on keeping on.